Is this the department?
Hello.
Yeah, who's this?
Hi, this is Rebecca. It's James.
Hi, Rebecca. James. Yeah.
Hey, I'm just, how are you?
Good morning, Sheriff. Members of the department, the Deputy Commissioner Santa Eford and Member Thompson with us.
Good morning, everyone. Kenny is here.
Hey. Keith Hamilton checking in. Good morning. Looks like we have enough to start. So is the department ready?
Yeah, we are ready, Chair Fields.
Okay, so I'll call the meeting to order at 9 a.m. And if you can stand wherever you're at for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag. Okay, thank you. The adoption of the agenda, whoever agenda item, if you could go ahead and remove item 3, the executive session, in your motion, then we can discuss the reasons why in our discussion.
Member Hamilton, I move to approve the agenda set before us with exclusion of the executive session number 3 at 12 noon today.
Member Gallo, in second.
Okay, thank you. Discussion. Mainly the reason why I'm talking to the commissioner is obviously we just got a budget passed and signed. So we feel we're better off moving that executive session item to the September face-to-face meeting so we can, you know, discuss it a little further in. So maybe we can, since the budget was just passed for this year. So that's the reasoning. Commissioner, do you want to add anything else to that, or is that?
No, that sums it up. September will be more timely, and so I just got a little ahead of myself by putting it on the August. It's better in August, and I think the conversation can be more substantive.
Okay, thanks. Any other discussion? Hearing no discussion, roll call, please.
Member Gallimore?
Here. Yes.
Dr. Hamilton?
Yes.
Second Vice Chair Harmon is excused today. Member Hemshoot?
Yes.
First Vice Chair Hall? Member Michael? Colonel Toole? Member Thompson?
Yes.
And Chair Fields.
Yes. Does anyone wish to change his or her vote this time? Hearing no changes.
Mr. Chair, the motion passes.
Okay, thank you. And I guess that will stand for a roll call because I forgot to do a roll call when you did a call to order, so that's my fault. But you did it now. Disclosure of potential conflict of interest. This is the time where if there's anything on the agenda that poses a conflict of interest, this is the time to voice it. Any conflicts of interest on this agenda? There are conflicts on the public comment. It's the time for the public to comment on open, on agenda, non-agenda items. Comment that this oral hearing is limited to 3 minutes per person and 5 minutes per group. Do we have anybody listed for public comment this time?
I have no one on the line and no one in the room, Chair Fields.
Okay. They're always welcome for public comment, so hopefully in the future we'll have some. But again, if you're listening, don't hesitate to give us any other comments, even though we get a lot of written ones, it's time to give oral comments. Okay, so moving right into our work session, item one, Every Student Succeeds Act, second draft, continued review. Commissioner?
The board will receive an update on the department's progress in developing Alaska's state application and gathering stakeholder input and feedback required by the federal Every Student Succeeds Act. And so we have Margaret McKinnon and let him go ahead and talk.
This is Audrey Meredith. We received public comments on the second draft. Online, we've had about 15 individuals go online and comment. We've had comments from the Panama Chiefs Conference, the National Indian Association. We've had a board member provide us with some questions. Rebecca, thank you for that. We are continuing to process those questions and comments and working on our third draft. At this time, we really want to open it up for additional dialogue with all of you. Any additional questions, and we can go through some of the questions that were asked of us previously, and also look to Rebecca's questions moving forward, if that's okay with the chair.
That sounds good.
So, Margaret, do you want to get started?
Sure. This is Margaret McKinnon, a federal programs coordinator. And I'll start by addressing questions from member Henshut that she sent by email on the accountability section. And I think if we discuss the topic and other people have questions or thoughts about it, that would be fine to weigh in at that time. So she asked about end of course assessments, being an exciting proposition, and who writes these assessments. And is there a national clearinghouse, or is it produced locally by teachers? The end of course assessments would be in place of, say, the ninth grade or 10th grade high school assessments. And so in all likelihood, the most efficient course would be to have our current test vendor produce those tests for us in lieu of the grade level tests. So that's, we'll be exploring that with our current vendor, DRC. In terms of a clearinghouse, the tests that we're using from DRC are based on their standards and their items to align to our standards. And so they do have items for high school, both in ELA and in math, and they can create and structure end of course assessments for us. Alaska educators are not necessarily part of that direct process, but they do have educators review the items that have been written, and so it's possible that we could be part of that process in the future. And also, educators are part of the alignment study process that makes sure that the items on our tests are aligned to our standards.
So. Margaret, should I, or Chairfield, should I ask, this is Rebecca, should I ask questions as we go, or?
Yeah, I think that's what Margaret mentioned, is if you've got questions as we go through the, you know, whatever these questions or the answers are, go ahead and ask those.
Okay, so our vendor, Margaret, has experience in writing this kind of a test, and they would base it on our standards. It would be tailored to Alaska.
Yes, that is correct. They do provide
Great, thank you.
Another state. And I just wanted to elaborate one more point on end of course assessments, just for clarification. At this point, we are not considering that they would be necessarily for a graduation requirement or even required for grades. It would just be an alternate way to assess students in high school by assessing them at when they've completed the content in a particular course, rather than everybody at the same grade level.
I have a question on that, actually. This is Member Michael.
Go ahead.
A lot of my peers and I completed Algebra 1, which is what it is what it says we're considering for the end of course assessment, in 7th or 8th grade. So would you take it at the end of 7th or 8th grade, or would you take it at the end of 9th grade when you were a high school student?
Thank you for that question, Member Michael. The law, as it does allow states to offer as an exception, eighth graders who are taking algebra, the end of course test in algebra, in lieu of the eighth grade test. And then in high school, those students who were on the advanced track would take a different content. So we would have to decide, you know, if it would be geometry or algebra 2 or what course it would be, so that those students did get a test in high school. ESSA does not currently allow for students in seventh grade to take the algebra course, although some states are asking for a waiver for that to be able to do that. We haven't discussed that yet in our state, but definitely it could be done for eighth graders.
Thank you.
And Margaret, this is Rebecca one more time. You may have said this, but so could a school decide if they're taking the regular statewide test or getting the end of course, or they're still going to have to do both, or is it a district choice, or would it have to be a statewide thing?
If it were eighth grade, where we have an eighth grade test, it would be a district choice if they chose to have their algebra students take the algebra end of course exam in lieu of the eighth grade test. In high school, there would be no end of grade test. It would be end of course for all high school students. And it would be the course at the time when they qualify for the content of the course that's being offered.
Okay.
The next question was, when will the to-be-determined sections on native language assessments be completed? The law does require us to indicate which languages we have that are present in the state to a significant degree and talk with stakeholders about designing assessments in those languages. And we have not yet had the opportunity to start that discussion with our stakeholders. It's definitely on the radar. It's likely that it won't happen before the plan gets submitted for the first time. So it would be a process that we would go through to discuss which assessments and what the timeline might be for that.
So again, Rebecca, this is not an issue then for the Department of Education if we turn something in that we haven't quite completed.
I think if we give them our plan, that's where we would be at that point in time. And if they give us feedback that they need more specific information, they would
And other states have submitted plans in a similar state with open-ended statements in there about what they are going to work on.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay.
So this is Chair Field, and so I'm just curious. Do you have any idea how many what you're looking at, and then how are you going to go about that? Is that going to be a position in the department, or multiple positions, or how will you go about getting those interpreted?
So if we were to move down the path for creating a test in another language, the first step would be to talk with our test contractor and work with them. And those details really have to be worked out in terms of how we would create a test in another language. So I'm sure that would be involved in that process.
Okay, and do you have any idea what we're how many we're talking or, yeah?
Well, I know that the largest percentage representation in our state of other languages is Yupik, and, you know, there are different dialects of Yupik. There is some work actually going on in Lower Kuskokwim District through a federal grant to develop some local assessments. So that would be, you know, probably the first language to be looked at. We do have some portion of students that are Spanish speakers. So it's about the number and percentage of students and what the advantages would be for having assessments in those languages.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, another question was about, from Member Hinshut, concerned about students in transition, or specifically students in foster care. Should they be included as a subgroup? Make sure they are supported at every opportunity. So the subgroup, there are subgroups that have been required for reporting under NCLB that aren't part of the accountability system, and that would include the subgroup of migrant students and now homeless students. I'm not sure if foster care are counted for reporting, but I think there are three subgroups haven't played into the accountability system. It's important to see how those students are performing, but they, you know, their status will change. They can move in and out of some of those statuses. I think there is definitely, we do have to have a foster care point person in the department. And some of the biggest concerns are making sure that there's support for the data to transfer school records and to maintain those students in their school of origin as much as possible when they're in the foster care system. So tighter connections with child services to make sure that those kids are recognized, schools know their situation.
Margaret, this is Rebecca, that feeds into a question that I have later. I don't know if I put it on that longer email, but later in the plan or somewhere I've seen there's mention of a person, I can't remember what they called it, but I'll just say a person who's tasked with basically taking care of the issues that you just mentioned. So does that mean that there's one person in the Department of Education who is managing, or not managing, but who is responsible for that? So when a child is in foster care, I just don't have enough experience with it. I have lots of children in foster care who are students, and I don't know the inner workings of how their transitions happen. So obviously OCS is involved. I just think of these as the most fragile kids. So we have one person in the department who's working with OCS, or how are those kids supported by the department?
A lot of the discussions about students in foster care in the past, they weren't directly called out under NCLB, but through the homeless liaison, part of that definition was students that were in transition or awaiting foster care. And I think what you're seeing in ESSA is the recognition that those students that transition, you know, very often the foster care situations are more transient, they're not as long term. And so ESSA requires us to have a homeless liaison in the state, and then we also have to have a foster care liaison who is a different person. I would say that primarily the work is coordinating with health and social services and making sure that districts have processes in place to know which students are in this situation and to make sure that, you know, their academic records go with them if they're transitioning schools. But other than that, there wouldn't be a strong role in the department for direct services to those students.
Okay, I guess I'm just thinking, you know, later in the plan, it's very well laid out, some of the challenges that we have in Alaska, some of the social challenges as far as we have a lot more students in this kind of transition than other states might expect to have. And so that's why I was thinking, do we need to identify them for more support in some way? But if it's done through McKinney Dental or whatever, then I guess I'm satisfied. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. And you also had a comment question about N size. If you were pleased with the N size, and how have other states fared with a variety of N sizes that have been proposed? Not sure if you want to clarify what you mean by fared.
Well, the 17 have submitted. How, like, is there feedback on the N sizes for those states who've already submitted?
Okay, I think I haven't read all the feedback, but what we have noticed is that most states are submitting probably smaller N sizes than they had before, in the range of maybe 10 or 15 seem to be the most prevalent. As long as they're justifying in their plans, you know, the rationale for that in their state, I don't think there's been a lot of feedback that they have to change anything.
Okay, great, thanks.
I haven't seen any specific feedback that other states have been inside. We've gotten some feedback that you know, some stakeholders want us to make our insides 5.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've gotten some feedback that I don't think other states have gotten from the USDA.
Has any state done anything smaller than 10?
Not that I can recall off the top of my head, but I don't have that in front of me.
Yeah, I'd be very worried about student privacy if we went much smaller than 10.
Well, our reporting in size and our accountability in size can be two different things, so you wouldn't have a reporting in size that small.
Oh, okay, good. That makes sense.
I know that previously under the waiver, some states, there were only 3 states that had N sizes smaller than 10. I don't know what those states have done. At this point, I'd have to look that up.
Well, it sounds like we're in the ballpark and we're probably not going to run into trouble with it, so great. If it's doing what we need to do and the department's happy, then we're all happy.
Thank you. So the next question was concerned about using interim assessments as an accountability measure. Can we trust local districts to monitor progress? What's the basis for using the assessment as an accountability measure? So I will say that the next draft will have more context around these accountability measures, especially school quality and student success, that weren't, you know, we didn't actually, weren't able to get all of that detail into the draft number 2. But we're not proposing to measure or have districts report on actual student progress. This proposal is to use it to incentivize districts using a system of interim assessment to ensure that they are measuring student progress and then taking their own action to provide support for students that need it. And one of the rationales for using it is trying to find measures for school quality and student success that measure what we know makes a good school, and that good schools are using this kind of a system, so to continue to encourage that. And then you also had a question about grade 3 literacy fitting better with academic measures, ELA and math. And could we look here to reward schools and districts that provide pre-K or solid professional development, or look for measure of family engagement? So again, this goes to the broader question of what we could include as a school quality and student success measure. And we're looking, it has to be a measure that is able to be disaggregated by subgroups across all the schools. And we know that there are other ideas out there, and some other states have maybe had more of a system in place with their, on their state side for several years, and they're including some things that we really were not
quite ready to just put into the accountability system in our state, and Commissioner Johnson is planning to continue those discussions, you know, with stakeholders to decide what really would make sense for us to measure and then start collecting data on, possibly piloting it for a few years before we include it in the accountability system. And the reason it's in the school quality and student success indicator at this point is because you're right, it is included in the academic achievement indicator already, but the school quality and student success indicator would just be an additional means to recognize how the importance of literacy by third grade for students. So it carries a little bit different flavor there and doesn't get, it calls it out rather than having it just kind of buried within the achievement level of all the students in the school. So that was the rationale there.
Okay.
And because we didn't have any other measures at this point, there's the early literacy screening requirements. Was repealed, so we're looking at the data that we could easily have available. The next question was, to please remind me the parameters for APS eligibility. Wasn't it on the chopping block? What if it goes away? Concerned that it's easy for large schools that offer AP or IB to support students in reaching those eligibility requirements. And yes, is the intent of APS eligibility to make sure every student has equal access to upper level courses? And I would say yes, that's the primary focus on having APS eligibility as school quality or student success indicator. It's something that districts have been reporting. It's been in place for a while. We don't know if the funding will continue, but it is available for next year. And it's something that, you know, we've had, and so it seems to be a good way to incentivize schools to make sure that students have access to those course options and some of the college career ready assessments.
Okay, so this is Rebecca. I guess my concern there is, you know, I like the focus on equity, but how do we support those districts where offering AP or IB is really difficult to do? So it's a heavier lift for rural schools to be able to offer those courses, obviously. So by putting it in the plan, we're shining a light on it and saying, okay, we need this. How do we make sure those schools have, my concern is twofold. One is it's making this a lot harder on districts, and how do we help those districts? And two is making it available is, you know, equality of access is not the same as an outcomes-based, just saying it's available doesn't mean that every student really can take it. I know that, I don't know in Alaska, but I do know that there are schools who say only certain kids can be in the AP or IB courses. They have to have, you know, these grades and that kind of thing, and that's, I think, a barrier for students. Just having the course offered doesn't mean that the students all are going to be able to take it. So I guess it's the first step, but first question, how do those districts who have a harder time offering those courses get support to offer them?
Hi, this is Bob Williams, Director of Educator and School Excellence, and I just say I appreciate your concern, and I'd say that I share it. There's a advanced placement colloquia in Louisville, Kentucky in October that Todd Rocious, who oversees Title IV in our department, is attending. And the focus, I've asked him to go there with, and I've had some discussions with other districts about this too, that have offered AP courses in Alaska. But his focus that I've asked him to look at is finding ways to better support rural school districts and increasing access to AP courses. So I think it's important. It is something that we're looking at. It's I would say that it is an important focus, and it's one that we are focused on.
Okay.
I'll press them.
Go ahead.
But I'll just add to that. You know, not every question will be answered with the submission of the ESSA plan. In other words, the implementation of the plan will raise some additional questions, and we anticipate those. And so, you know, like what Bob's saying is we've anticipated those, and we're already working on it. But what's best for the students in the state? And so as we think through that, I think your questions are absolutely valid. They're questions that have been asked in the department. And so we're going to keep working on them, and even through implementation, as more questions arise in terms of, you know, how do we create a plan that works for every single school, not just every single district, but every single school in this state. And we're just, as a department, committed to asking that question repeatedly and then working through the answers. Paul?
Yes. When the APS, the Performance Scholarship, first rolled out, what we saw was districts shining a light on courses that they weren't offering. So really what the APS did is made districts step up their game a little bit and increase the number of classes that they could offer to students. So it wasn't necessarily about the advanced placement courses as much as access to enough courses to qualify for the scholarship. So we saw a huge increase in some of these smaller districts being creative. We saw yesterday at the Superintendent Flying how districts were starting to offer distance-delivered courses and sharing teachers. That was really, in my opinion, a direct result of the APS program. And even if the last performance scholarship goes away, I think we still want to shine a light on that and encourage districts to continue offering a wide variety of courses. So that was just helpful.
Thank you. Yeah, I think what I'm hearing is a lot of this is aspirational, which is what I want our plan to be. My personal opinion is that we should have goals that we're striving for. So that's what this is. These things are not necessarily universally happening, but our goal is to make sure that they are, and whatever support is needed will be identified and given. Correct?
Yes, and this is Bob Williams again. And I would just add that I think I had a conversation with Deputy Assistant Secretary of Education, Dr. Monique Chisholm in D.C., I think it was like a week and a half ago, but in that conversation, one of the things she mentioned was the importance of defining things. I mean, there's sometimes the state would say something, we want to have strong courses or rigorous courses, but it isn't really clear how it's defined. One nice thing is about the APS, it's clearly defined, so it isn't open to a whole bunch of different options. Interpretation. So having clear definitions is helpful.
So I'm going to indulge myself in just a little comment. My own nephew graduated from Dillingham, and he was waitlisted at MIT because he lacked certain courses. And those courses, had he had a counselor directing him, neither of his parents completed college. So he was a first-generation college student or applicant to college. And the counselors didn't direct him to, my nephew was perfectly capable of taking an online calculus course, but never did. And so he knocked out calculus as a freshman easily at a different university. But I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is we need to think about counseling and how we, of the many things that we're being asked to do, I'd like us to also think about making sure that students know what they need, and maybe APS is a great way for us to get there, and this focus is good, and I'm trying to be supportive. But then the other thing that I think we need to be thinking about is first-generation students and getting them into the AP and IB courses. It's one thing to offer them, it's quite a different question to make sure that students can get in, and specifically, I'm thinking about a student with an IEP who may or may not feel welcome to move at the pace, and yet is perfectly capable of doing the work. So I guess I would just encourage us to continue with our aspirational thinking with the plan and look for places to maybe improve counseling, especially for first-generation students, in relation to these rigorous courses. So I think I'm done. Thank you for listening.
Okay, so there was a comment that you liked the changing goals, so that's not a question, so I'll move on. This is Margaret McKinnon again for the record. And the last question in the accountability section was concerned about holding schools responsible for the 95% participation rate, needing a lot of support from DEED and even from the legislature to turn around the idea that testing is bad. Is there a plan for this and to safeguard schools and districts as much as possible? So I will say that the law does require this 95% participation rate, and one of the requirements is the way student achievement is calculated. If fewer than 95% of your students test, you still have to count 95% and measure the achievement as if 95% had tested. So there will be an impact on the achievement component of the accountability index because of that. And a requirement for a school improvement plan. So that disconnects that has that requirement, but also recognizes, you know, the authority of states and parents not to have their children test is where we're going to work with schools to the degree possible to make sure that they have a communication strategy for their teachers as well as their parents about why the assessments are important, why it's, you know, a thin layer. We're not asking for a significant amount of time, but it's an important way to measure how the schools are doing. And I think that there will probably be less parent opt-out because of that kind of communication maybe than there was this year, especially if they realize it involves your school's accountability piece. But we'll just to work on that.
Right, and Rebecca again, and I think I was very interested in seeing family engagement as part of the school quality and student success indicator, and this is a form of parent engagement or family engagement if districts are working with families to make sure the goals of testing are clear and that families are making an informed decision. That's a form of family engagement. So I think I like it for that reason. I'm worried about districts being, so to speak, punished for what may not be a clear understanding on the part of parents. And I know the district needs to do the work to make sure parents understand what we're doing and to earn their trust. But that, you know, that's in some districts, that's a really historically that's been a difficult conversation. So I'm just a little concerned about how we support those districts or how we change what people are hearing from the department, from the legislature, from various sources, not just from districts. So, thanks.
Okay. So I'm going to stop on your questions now because they move into other sections of the plan. But wanted to say that for the accountability section in particular, we have gotten some other feedback and support from external agencies. The idea that we want to control basically as much of our educational system and plan as we can. And so we'll probably, the third draft will probably see a little bit less specific in some of the ways the points are calculated to describe what we're going to do and meet the requirements of the plan, but leave more of the details in our control as we work through regulations to implement this plan. And all of, you know, so much of those ideas about the ways we can support schools. And the idea is that we want to have a plan that's approvable and is providing that context for our state, and yet not have to submit for reapproval for some minor changes that we may want to make or tweak. We can always submit this plan again to be reviewed. But, you know, trying to find that balance of what needs to go in this plan versus what's part of our larger plan for our support for our schools in the state of Alaska. So that's really, I think, the comments that I had. If other members have questions on the accountability section, I would be glad to entertain those.
This is Member Thompson. I just have a brief comment, and it's that the plan is something that is evolving and will evolve even after we submit it. And so to build in as much flexibility as we can into that plan and have this plan reflect the direction that we're taking in the state makes sense. And so there are going to be a lot of unanswered questions, and the 95% participation issue is, you know, an issue. There are people who are just totally against testing of any kind, and the opt-out is an option. So, but anything we can do for flexibility in that area and other areas, it's going to change, and the department needs that flexibility to be able to submit changes as they need to, and not come looking for formal approval to get that submitted. That's it.
Okay, if there are no further questions, I think the next section would be school improvement.
School improvement, yes, and Brad Billings is here to answer questions about that piece.
Brad Billings, administrator for school improvement. So I'm responding then to Member Hemshute, your inquiry on page 36 about what is Alaska's continuous school improvement planning tool. So ESSA does require that schools designated as comprehensive support and improvement or targeted support and improvement, that they have a school improvement plan process in place. Alaska currently supports the Alaska STEP platform. This is an Indistar platform that's used by multiple states. We provide training throughout the fall in the form of webinars or one-on-one support. And then our on-site school improvement coaches, they base their work within that school improvement tool as well, and they're providing assistance to the school to complete the tool. I will note that our current regulations do provide for districts to propose an alternative planning tool. We currently have three districts that have determined that there's a process that works better for them, and they're using that currently. So that's something that we will continue to support, is that flexibility.
Okay, great.
This is Chair Fields. So we're looking at this, and I think this is obviously the goal. When looking at this, how much of obviously is already being done? How much is in addition to, and how is the department, if there is additions to, how is the department looking at either getting more people or meeting those needs financially and personnel-wise?
Yeah, capacity is definitely an issue that we're looking at. I think, let me give you some context. So 4 years ago, as we were working with the ASPE system, the department had an EED liaison, is what we called them, who was reaching out and supporting on the order of 80 of our 500 schools. So one- and two-star schools had a contact at the department that was designed to assist them in the school improvement planning process. That capacity has been decreased over the last 3 years. So currently we have two individuals. We anticipate that our school improvement coaches, 17 contractors, will continue to support specifically the schools designated as comprehensive support and improvement. That may be 15 to 20 schools. We'll then have that cohort of schools that don't meet the 67% graduation rate that will need support on that school improvement planning. And then the targeted support and improvement schools, those schools identified for subgroup performance will also need to do that school improvement planning. So we're considering how to use our resources to meet some of those additional needs, similar to what we were doing perhaps 4 years ago.
Okay, thank you.
Not hearing any other questions, this is Sandra Maris for the record. We're going to go ahead and move on to the teacher quality pieces, which show up both in the Title I section of the plan and also the Title IIA part of the plan.
Cecilia Miller is here with me to work through the questions for this section. We'll go ahead and just get started with the questions that Rebecca asked, and then if there's more questions, we can move into those as well. So the first question was why we compare ineffective in Title I-A and effective in non-Title I-A schools. And that is part of the equity piece of this, making sure that we are that students from are economically disadvantaged have equitable access to educators in their schools as their peers in non-title schools. And so that's really a federal requirement that is part of what they expect to see on school report card or the state report card as well as the district report card.
Sandra, can I ask about that?
Go ahead. Actually, can I acknowledge that as a mistake? It should say ineffective.
Oh, then okay. Then I have no questions. That totally makes sense. Thank you. It seemed like we were looking at two variables, and then got it.
Thank you for the edit.
Sure. Wow, that totally makes sense now. Thank you.
Totally misread the question. Sorry about that. Okay, so moving into the next question was about, it was just a question about is there a mechanism for which schools will report on filled positions, and actually beginning August 31st as part of a regulatory package that was passed by the board not too long ago, the districts are now going to be reporting to us on filled positions so that we can get some real data on across the last districts on and schools where they're having trouble filling those positions.
Sandra, this is Rebecca. I want to go back to the little typo for ineffective. The bottom two bullet points on page 38, it looks like we're also looking at ineffective high minority and effective low minority. To me, that's two variables. Is that possibly another one of those typos?
Same one.
Thank you.
Okay. And then, it makes sense now. And then what you're saying about reporting unfilled positions, I guess I should have known we're doing that. So what is considered an unfilled position where there's no one even on the horizon? Like if they have a long-term sub for the first, like if their intent is to fill the position, at what point do we call that an unfilled position? Is it possible there are unfilled positions that last an entire year?
Our focus with the way the regulation was written is really looking at the first days of school and to see if the district has positions that they do not have a contracted teacher filling. There will be circumstances when they do have a person under contract that has a known absence. Those individuals that position wouldn't be part of the collection. But vacant meaning they don't have an individual under contract for that position, those are really what we're looking for in the data collection.
And how will that information be shared with the public?
That's yet to be determined.
Okay. I just feel like that's a really important, if we're going to talk about ineffective teachers and use other terms that are difficult for me to stomach, I also want people to realize, you know, people don't necessarily recognize the teacher shortage until they see numbers. So I'm really glad we're going to be able to, by whatever means, share that. We'll at least have, you know, fact-based information that we can share in some way in the future. Thanks for that.
All right. The next inquiry was around the equity plan, which is something that we are using quite a bit within the Title II section, or actually the information about the disbursement of teachers. Sorry. And I did provide that to you, Rebecca. If any of the other board members are interested in that, I can make sure that they have a link.
Andre, was that in a separate email then?
Yes, I sent it. I sent a separate email with a hyperlink to that.
Okay. Somehow I missed that, but I'll go back and find it. Thanks.
Okay. And additional questions around the equity plan. When we wrote the equity plan, thinking about a limited amount of resources, the 12 districts that were identified just was seemed to be the place to cut when we looked at the data, the ones that were having the most issues with retention in our state.
So the number 12 came from the plan, from the 2015 equity plan?
That's correct.
We factored in there where their school was performing, so that dropped off some districts that and schools that were performing well but still had a equity access issue.
Great, thank you.
Right, and so the initials for the future educators of Alaska, that was in the Venn diagram. Rebecca, was your next question, and that's been noted, and we'll change that in the next draft to recognize the change in that program to Educator Rising.
Yeah, kudos to Steve Atwater.
And then under the training and technical assistance piece, you are inquiring about training on bullying and harassment and whether or not that is a required training for our teachers. I am unsure. I looked at the list, and I don't believe that that's a requirement, but we are aware that that's going on across our district at this point in time. There's a lot more sensitivity to that particular issue, but it's not a mandate.
Yeah, so I guess I'm just looking for advice here. I'd really like to look at what are we requiring teachers to learn about, and maybe we can update that and take a few things off the plate and put a few things on the plate as times change. And so I guess, is that up to us to do, or is that a statute? Who decides what's a mandatory training for teachers?
Many of those are embedded in our statutes.
Most
are embedded in our statutes, actually.
Yeah, I did the trauma sensitivity training, the trauma-informed practices training that Todd directed me to, and it was great, but I was thinking, the fact that it exists is great. The fact that it's available is great, but getting people to actually do it is, that's a little bit bigger leap.
This is Bob Williams. There are teachers and people getting certificates have four mandatory trainings. One's on sexual abuse awareness and prevention, Alaska Statute 1433-55. Suicide Awareness and Prevention, 1433-62, Alcohol or Drug Related Disabilities, Alaska Statute 1420-680, and Dating Violence Awareness and Prevention, Alaska Statute 1430-356. As you noted, there are other e-learning courses that we're developing and that are out there, but those are the four that are required through legislation.
Bob, can I just ask, I have to do bloodborne pathogens, I have to do McKinney-Vento, I have to do a lot of other trainings. Is it my district asking me to do that? Or is that somehow, and it's not every year, some trainings are every other year, some are every 5 years?
This is
where are those coming from?
There are other statutorily required trainings, in addition to those four that are the newest ones.
Okay.
And required for certification.
Yes, and some are required as long as that's a recertification.
Yeah. And
so
I think there's state-required training, there's district-level required training, so there's both.
Yeah.
So maybe even
so. Yeah. Right. Okay, thanks. I can look into that more. Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Moving down. I think we've talked about the foster care question already. I'm going to go ahead and let have Celia speak to the recognition programs, and Bob may want to chime in as well, that we are currently engaged in here at the department. Celia?
Yes, this is Celia with her records. We definitely have been doing the militant for quite a number of years. Actually, Member Thompson had the pleasure of doing that as well, which is at the department. We also have the Teacher of the Year program as a recognition program. And then last year, we worked as in a part of a coalition and elevating and celebrating excellent teachers program. And that's something that the goal of that group was that we go regional. So we're foreseeing, I think, Matt Sue and Anchorage and possibly here in Juneau are going to be doing regional ones. But the idea was to try and let it be a community ownership. The group did talk about trying to do more of a rural one because you don't have enough teachers. And at least this year we decided that we didn't want to apply for a grant to do that. It's something we can look at again next year. I think it's a very powerful event. Bob was there as one of our speakers, maybe, and he's gone to a few. Maybe he can talk about it a little bit more.
Yeah, I'd say that the two main programs that run in the Division of Educator School Excellence is the Milken and Alaska Teacher of the Year. We want to elevate teacher leaders, and the ESET 2 conference last year definitely did that and was very well done. They're looking at trying to increase. There's also sometimes there's some recognition programs that aren't run through the department, but we still interact with sometimes the Presidential Awards for Excellence in Mathematics and Science Teaching. And I also say that there's sometimes we get requests for national committees that are looking for very specific things. An award-winning teacher that is working in a school with high levels of economic disadvantaged students that meets certain criteria. And we submitted a couple names for a national committee a month and a half ago, and I got an email from a teacher from Wendler Middle School thanking that her name was put forward, and she was on her way to D.C. and represent Alaska in the teaching profession. So we want to highlight and recognize and make sure that we can attract and retain highly effective teachers.
And actually, that reminds me, we are working with a couple social studies groups on trying to advertise their awards through our page, through our recognition page. And then we just had a new award, a science award that a guy from Craig was nominated for. He went and presented with the American Gas Association in Anchorage. So I think we're finding more opportunities than just trying to advertise them and get them to teachers.
Great, thanks for that.
All right, I'm going to go down to your question about the Alaska Transition to Teaching Program. This was, we spoke in the plan about exploring alternative routes to certification. The most recent example we have here at the department is the federal grant that we received to offer that. It was a program that went on for 4 years. I do have additional information about some of the details of that, but we produced about 50, I want to say between 50 and 60 teachers that went to various districts, and at least 50% of them are, I think, still in the rural areas teaching or at least in Alaska teaching. The program itself was a standards-based approach that required a number of different activities of the individuals engaged, starting with activities over the course of about 6 months that led up to a intensive program in Anchorage where the candidates were working with the students, with students in the Anchorage school districts that were attending government schools. Those individuals that received job offers from districts in rural Alaska, our partner districts, would then go to those districts and, while they were teacher of record, finish a portfolio over the course of 2 years showing that they had met the standards for the beginning teacher in Alaska. the minimum qualifications for that program included having a bachelor's degree in a content-specific area. They also had to pass all of the testing requirements required for initial certification in the state, both the basic competency and a content area exam. And so that in a nutshell was the program. We had two positions here, actually three positions when it was fully operational that those grant funds supported. Since those funds have gone away, the program has been discontinued, but we still have a lot of information from those programs still here at the department, and as we move forward and discuss the idea of a transition program in the state, it would be something that we could definitely access and learn from moving forward.
Yeah, it's nice to know that there's something that successful that we can continue to look at. I know that the committees in the Educator Excellence group are looking at that. So thanks for the additional information. When you say they had 2 years to build the portfolio, Sandra, that's they're in a classroom. They're like actively in a classroom.
Yes.
While they're, okay, got it. Thanks.
We're also very much supported both by the folks that were here at the department. They also, each of them were required to have a mentor from our Alaska Mentors Program, Alaska Teacher Mentor Program. And of course, they also got additional support from their district, knowing that they were, novice teachers that needed that additional support, especially around things like classroom management and lesson planning and standards, and making sure folks were addressing those standards of both the district and the state.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and have Cecilia talk briefly about your inquiry around blended learning and personalized learning, the use of those terms.
Great. So actually in our plan, we do mean to reference actually both of them as two separate things. So our digital teaching initiative grants that came from the legislature directly, they were the 3-year grants, those districts are really working on blended learning. Like the Copper River School District, where they have the guy in Anchorage that's doing video conferencing back to some of their smaller sites. So we want to make sure we're capturing some of the things that they've learned and disseminating those. We actually have an evaluator that has a very nice report that we need to do a little bit of dissemination with. Those districts, as well as some of the other districts like Kenai and Fairbanks, have been looking very strongly at personalized learning for kids. And so we also want to make sure that as they learn stuff, we share that information out. So I think what would maybe help is if we provided a definition of blended learning in there so they understand we are talking about two different things.
Sounds good. I see the two things intersecting, but I feel strongly that they are separate. So thanks for that.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and have Margaret address the question concerning the differentiated diplomas.
Thank you for the record. This is Margaret McKinnon. And Member Hinchett, you asked if there was a way under the ESSA plan to create a differentiated diploma, perhaps a basic diploma, with the endorsements for students who have completed CTE or advanced academic courses. The answer under ESSA is that no, it only recognizes a regular diploma for all students with the possibility of a state having a diploma that would recognize the 1% of students that are students with significant cognitive disabilities. And we have not, we've determined not to pursue that at this time. So the conversation at the state level could take place at a different time, but it would not be recognized under ESSA.
Great. Yeah, I didn't know if there was a place in ESSA for that or if that's something that we deal with, you know, if each state creates their own system for that. So thanks.
Yeah, there are states that do have some different options, but we haven't, it's not permitted under ESSA.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, guys. This is a lot of questions. I really appreciate your time. And everybody else having to listen to my questions being answered. Thank you.
So we've answered all of Member Hinch's questions. So if other, if there are other questions from other board members, we would entertain them now.
This is Member Hamilton. Good morning, everybody. I had a question regarding page 24, the chronic absenteeism issue continuing. And as I looked at our point system and realized that, you know, all of our point systems have got basically very similar level 1, 2, 3, 4, and 0. And I appreciate the way that it's very easy to figure this out. You got percentages, you got points numbers, et cetera, and then you pick your level. I'm concerned back with the chronic absenteeism part of this question. This is the only time in the whole ESSA that I could recall when I read through it that we kind of have this opportunity to discuss this. But I know that in our Office Education Challenge Subcommittee, we are heavily engaged in this conversation, and it's a pretty big thing for us. I'm wondering if there's going to be further opportunity to make this a larger issue for the ESFA or not. Everybody's happy with what we see. I highlighted the second part here, research indicates that schools with more rates of chronic absenteeism correlate generally with higher academic achievement. We all, of course, believe that and understand that, but I just wish it was more prominent. Is it listed anywhere else? Am I correct to see that, Margaret?
Well, it's listed as an indicator. I think all the information from all the indicators would play into the needs assessments for schools that aren't succeeding and ways to support those schools. So that's, you know, at this point, it's just one of several proposed chronic, school quality indicators. So, that's your
job. I have some concerns with chronic absenteeism as an indicator in our accountability system. And I can just mention a few now. Happy to follow up with a longer conversation with you, Member Hamilton. But I think we have to be careful when using chronic absenteeism, particularly in Alaska, because of some various dynamics. One would be that, you know, if you go to the orthodontist and you let them stay with A, that's an entirely different absentee issue than if you go in to the orthodontist and you let them Anchorage or Juno. And if you live in Alaska and you have family outside and a grandma dies, you know, that's 5 days of absences. And if you play sports in Alaska, let's say you play basketball and volleyball, you could be gone out of the classroom 20 days in a given year. If you start removing all those from the metrics, then you end up with a meaningless metric. Secondly, if we are going to put chronic absenteeism in this plan in a prominent way, then I feel strongly that we need to put teacher absenteeism there in the same way. Then you have the same problem. Teachers are entitled to their sick leave. They earn that. They're entitled to personal leave. They earn that. If they have a medical issue and they teach in a remote village, they're going to be out of the classroom for a considerable amount of time. And so then you get, you start getting again to a meaningless metric if you start taking those out of the equation. And so I think it's a bigger conversation. I'm in no way saying that absenteeism isn't important. It's an important dynamic. But to put it in the accountability system, may not accomplish what we want to and may create some difficulties in other areas. So while I'm very grateful to the Alaska Education Challenge Committee for addressing and talking about that issue. I'm not sure it's a smooth transition into the accountability system. So it's a conversation that we can keep having along with some other parts of it. But, so I'll just add that and leave it there for now.
This is Member Hamilton. I was disconnected. I missed the end of the first part of Margaret's answer. I apologize. I heard you say that it's an indicator, and then I heard the commissioner finish it up, so I think I'm okay, but did I miss anything in between, perhaps?
Probably a few coughs, sniffs, and other
things. Basically, Member Hamilton, we have it as an option, and if schools are having difficulty in this area, we could provide support as part of that school support side of the equation. And then commissioners' concerns are that the differences in our needs for kids to be absent in our state context is really different maybe than the way this indicator is designed to be measured. Not an example of a student needing to go to the orthodontist from a rural community versus, missing an hour of school from Anchorage or Juneau and other ideas like that.
I understand. I don't know what our statewide numbers are, but I imagine that we're going to score very low in these areas as our indicator in this specific area, both in if we had a measurement for teacher absenteeism as well as student absenteeism, I think we'd find ourselves in pretty low scores here, and that continues to be difficult for me to see as our progress needs to be ahead in this area especially. Thank you.
This is Chair Fields. What feedback have you gotten back on these school indicators? Good, bad, both? What's in the feedback?
So, Chair Fields, Margaret McKinnon, it's kind of mixed feedback on some of the indicators. We got a significant amount of new feedback last night, as that was the deadline for the public comment, which we have not yet had a chance to digest completely.
I'll just add my email. Amelia Inbox had several emails this morning with feedback, and we want to legitimately consider all that, and so we'll make sure the board, gets the benefit from that too.
Okay, thank you.
Margaret, this is Rebecca with one, I promise you, final comment or question. There's a lot of stuff outlined in the plan that's going to require the department to do, to make some changes, some new things, some adjustments. Are we allowed to stagger that so that staff isn't hit with an onslaught of new changes and new things all at once? Can we implement things on a sliding timeline, or once this is submitted and approved, do people have to turn on a dime and start making things happen?
Member Hemshut, we do have some flexibility potentially in when we roll some new indicators into the plan, things like that, but the basic plan would be implemented based on the 2018 data. So we have 2017 assessment data as our baseline, and then 2018 to measure growth and apply all of the indicators to the schools. So they would get their rating, if you will, or designation that would apply for the 18-19 school year. We are potentially going to clarify that we'll hold off on a couple of types of schools where we haven't had an opportunity to fully flesh out the types of indicators that would be the most applicable, say, for like the alternative schools. So you'll see some of that in this next draft of the plan, clarifying what we might say is in. But that's why we're trying to include information that's either already collected or would not require
too much of a significant additional data collection that could be implemented for 17-18.
Okay, my concern was just making sure you guys aren't hit with a ton of bricks, but it sounds like you're going to, a lot of this is already happening anyway, so.
Well, our capacity is always one of our considerations.
Yeah, I guess that was my concern. Thanks.
Board Member Himshue, this is Sandra Meredith for the record. I'd also just remind the board that, you know, as we're not putting a lot of details into the plan, what that's going to mean is, and it would mean so even if we did put a lot of details, is that all of this, especially the accountability system and some of the data collections that we're going to be needing to make part of the plan, will be a part of regulatory packages that the board will see. So when we get down to the nitty-gritty and the detail of this, the board will see that detail and will be able to revisit this through the regulatory process, which I think is a really important thing for everyone to keep in mind, that this is an outline of a plan. As we move forward, we'll figure out those details. One of the big things that we don't have right now that we'll need is just data itself so that we can figure out what's appropriate and how to roll these indicators or how to develop the initial measure for the indicator and roll that into the overall rating or designation. So just a reminder of that process.
Great, thanks.
Any other questions, comments from board members?
Member Hamilton, one quick comment probably for the commissioner. I was at the ACPE meeting last week in Anchorage, and the question came up, how similar is ESSA to NCLB? And I think somebody before me, the commissioner, had stated that there was a large percentage of similarity and then some dissimilarity, of course. And I responded with what I thought I had heard, and now that we have the second draft in place, somebody just quickly tell me, you know, how I would answer that question if it was asked of me again.
Well, I'll start. So I would answer the question by saying there are some landmark elements of ESSA, I have no time left behind, that remain in ESSA, such as testing in grades 3 through 8, the accountability system in identifying schools or distinguishing schools. And so, you know, those are big parts of No Child Left Behind, kind of landmark elements of No Child Left Behind that remain in ESSA. But the disposition of ESSA is different than No Child Left Behind, whereas No Child Left Behind had those landmark elements. If a school was labeled as not performing well, then the consequences of that were very prescriptive. In ESSA, when a school is labeled not performing well, the consequences are not as prescriptive and are more of a local responsibility, school by school. So while there are some elements that remain the same that I think surprise people, because the hype at the beginning very much was how different ESSA was. And it is in disposition, but it wasn't completely different. So I hope that helps. Margaret, Sandra, anybody else? Bob, want to add to that?
This is Margaret. I would say that we outlined some of those key differences on the front page of the executive summary. That under NCLB, it was the all or nothing category. If one subgroup missed one of the targets, then the school was put into improvement, you know, or not meeting AYP status. And here, while some of those elements are present, there's additional ones allowed. And basically, the state flexibility on how to design that overall accountability system and the consequences and supports are what the states have much more flexibility in under ESSA.
This is Bob Williams. I would just say that you know, NCLB had this piece where you had to, if you missed one indicator, you were considered a failing school, and it had a target rate of 100% by 2014, so that all schools would be considered failures practically. And so there, compared to that, ESSA is incredibly flexible. And yet I'd say the places where it has less flexibility is the, I feel like under Commissioner Johnson's leadership and the department, we invested a considerable amount of time trying to come up with what I thought were fairly innovative, you know, maybe trying to measure some things with CTE, maybe trying to, and it was what we heard from stakeholders, maybe Alaska Native culture and Native languages, and some great things that if schools focused on those two, they would improve. But the statutes are of ESSA don't have a lot of flexibility there. It all has to be disaggregated by subgroups, and there was no flexibility, and there wasn't a way around it. So it is. Is it more flexible than NCLB? Absolutely. Was it as flexible as we wanted? No.
And then I'll just close the loop a little bit and say, but ESSA is more data. ESSA loves data. It likes data, and so that's going to be an increased requirement on our districts. And I think that's where we as a department and you as a state board have to be thinking about how are we going to serve our districts and our individual schools so that this extra data requirement doesn't take away from their focus on instruction in the classroom. And, you know, that may take different forms, including, you know, educating the legislature and others on what this new requirement is and the value of that data. I think data has great value when it's used correctly. And so as we build up that capacity, that's a conversation and a point of advocacy that I think the State Board of Education can have on behalf of our schools and districts.
Okay, keep going.
I was waiting for additional questions.
I'm not hearing any. So, Commissioner, can you mention, you mentioned to me about, is it we're not necessarily voting on this, can you go ahead and go over that statement you told me earlier?
Member Thompson is also kind of an expert in this area based on her leadership in the department when we had, you know, previous federal versions of ESCA. So we're not asking the board to make a formal vote on approving the plan. What we're asking is that the board endorse the submission of the plan. And the reason is because I want to be respectful of when the board does take formal action. So if you voted on the plan today, then I would be very reluctant to make changes to that plan before it was submitted because that's what you made a formal vote on. This plan, we will be considering feedback up until the time of submission. Will we be making dramatic changes? Probably not, because the feedback we've gotten so far is that, you know, people are satisfied with large parts of this plan. We will make tweaks based on the feedback up until, you know, as long as we get feedback. I think it's most respectful of the board to say, as you see the plan now, as you see how we've incorporated feedback, that you endorse that, you know, by this conversation, and then we'll keep working on it and keep the board fully informed. Where the board takes formal action is when you pass regulations associated with this plan, and that's where you really take a formal vote. But Member Thompson, we had a brief conversation. Do you want to add to that?
This is Member Thompson. And my recollection over the many years that I remember these kind of plans coming through, the board did not take formal action on the plan submission itself, but did clearly weigh in on the regulations that implement the plan and implement the plan in school districts. The department really does need the flexibility to float and submit changes. The board would obviously know about changes and if any of them required regulations, yes, for the board and the board would have its opportunity to clearly state either approval of the regulations that are proposed or go in another direction. So if by not voting on the plan at this point, that you're not going against anything that's happened in the past. In fact, it's been this way, and again, but that's it. I keep talking. I'm just rambling.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, there's no formal endorsement process that I see today. Is this something where you just want to, you know, by not objecting, we're endorsing, or how do you see us moving forward with this endorsement?
Let's just continue conversations like we're having today, where we get, you know, your questions, your feedback, and we keep moving forward. We, you know, we made your objections, that sort of thing. So we, you know, we just appreciate the opportunity to work with the board. Because the board's feedback is obviously really important to us. That's why we're spending this time. And as we, you know, as the board kind of analyzes how we're incorporating feedback and responding to stakeholders, that's
okay. Any other questions, comments from board members on this work session item? I'm not hearing any more. I think you guys are doing a great job getting all the implement and putting it into the plan, and so keep doing that, and we'll get closer and closer to submission. Item 2, budget review, FY 18.
Okay. On the department, 2018 impacted operating.
Good morning. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Director of Finance and Support Services. And just so you know, it says in the agenda cover page that on June 30th, the governor approved and signed into law HB 57 and 59, so the two operating bills, with about $1.9 billion that the legislature passed. Behind the memo, we're both through a little highlights of the budget, but then I'll come back and talk about, not mentioned in here, but we'll talk about the capital budget as well as the intent language. So I'm going to move to page 6 of the board packet. I'm going to just a high level, because I want to really highlight the changes that happened from the governor's to the finally enacted. But so you can see the final budget for the department, it's $1.7 billion. We luckily didn't have to take any PCN reductions from governor, so there's still a total of 298 total positions in the department. Overall funding, there's 82% of our overall budget is general funds, 14% is federal, and 4% is other. I'm going to go down to the file 2 graphs on page 6 of the board packet just to highlight that, you know, 95% of our entire budget goes out the door in grants to school districts and other grantees. 3% are other lines, and that's our travel, commodities and services, and 2% is personal services. And that bottom graph just highlights by line item the UGF, the unrestricted general fund. On page 7 of the board packet is overall enacted budget by component, by fund source. So it's broken out between the K-12 formula programs and the agency and program operations. Again, you can see there's a total of $1.7 billion is the total budget. On page 8, and please stop me if there's any questions. Page 8 of the budget just shows the general funds for the department, comparing FY17 management plan to FY18 enacted and what those changes are. Overall, in our K-12 formula programs, there was an increase of $36 million and some change, so 2.7% increase in there. The biggest changes is the pupil transportation was fully funded for FY18. And had a reduction in 17, so you're seeing that $6.4 million increase there And then same with the school debt reimbursement. There was an increase of just over $24 million. That's because there was a 25% reduction in 17 in full. Down in our agency and program operations, overall there was a 5% decrease, just over $3 million decrease. And the biggest contributor to that was that for Mount Edgecombe, they did a fund source switch from UGF to Public Health Trust Fund, and that was a one-time switch. So in FY19, it's going to go back to be UGF instead of the Public School Trust. And I'll highlight some of these other changes in a couple pages preceding or following this. On page 9 of the board packet is the total all funds comparing FY17 action plan to FY18 enacted. Overall, there was a 2.5% increase of about $43.6 million increase for all funds. Page 10 of the board packet really shows the detail, and I apologize for the small font in order to fit it all on one page. This shows by line kind of the detailed changes from FY17 management plan to FY18 enacted. Is there a question? Nope. I just want to highlight there's just a handful of lines that changed from the original governor's, and so line 6. Just to highlight again that pupil transportation was fully funded in the FY18 enacted budget, so just want to highlight that. On line 22, there was a reduction of $52,800 to the TVEP, so the Technical Vocational Education Program allocation for Galena, and that was based on delayed projections from labor, so there's a slight decrease to that program. But they did get... the sunset was renewed, so they continued funding into 18. Line 29, there's $1.2 million that was added in, and this is for continuing early education programs related to the Moore versus state settlement, so kind of a transitional period. This is a one-time item. On line 33, the original budget had $100,000 requested for warm storage of the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center, and they've made this just a one-time item, so not a base item. Line 35 shows you that fund source switched to the Mount Edgecombe High School's appropriation, so changing it from the unrestricted general fund to the public school trust fund. And again, that was a one-time switch. And then on line 52, the original governor's budget requested a $106,000 increase for the WAMI contractual increases, and then the final budget only settled on a $50,000 increase. And that the WAMI program is under ACPE. Do you have any questions on this page before I continue? Okay. Line or page 11 of the board packet just shows you for the foundation program the changes from school count and the line items within the formula from FY17 authorized to FY18 enacted, basically. And then on page 12 shows you by school district. The formula program allocations, or the state program allocations, so by program, foundation, pupil trans, boarding home, all of those by school districts. So overall, a little over $1.4 billion going to school districts projected for 18. And these are based, subject to change based on, you know, final student count. Page 13. Just shows you the breakdown. Again, it's also on page 12, but a little more detail on the school debt reimbursement program and how those are going to be allocated to districts and boroughs. About $115.9 million. Pages 14 and 15 give you a little bit more detail on the well, it's no longer really a division of teaching and learning support. So this is really the student learning and early and educator school excellence divisions. How their programs are broken down, so student school achievement, what's all included in there by fund source. Gives you guys a little bit more detail so you can see where things are at in the budget. And then on page 16 of the board packet is the pencil chart, shows you the BSA from FY 2008 to FY 18 and how that's changed. So any questions on the operating budget? Am I hearing
anything? I don't know. Well, this is Chair Field. Let's go back up to, I guess it'd be page 11 in the board packet.
Yep.
Any words on that? You got regular ADN and the correspondence. You see regular ADN go down 292, of course, as projected, and correspondence went up 662. Anything around that anybody could add about that, you know, where education's going, or is it just that's just what's projected? Any wisdom on that?
No. We don't. Sorry, Chair Field. Looking around the head and everybody's shaking their head no. I think it's
okay.
Good how people project it. I think districts tend to project low for some reason, and then they come in with higher actuals, which we try to get them to not do that because that affects the budget. But that's just they like to be conservative, not really knowing where the state's going to go.
But on the correspondence side, I'm assuming the districts are doing the same on that side, or where does that number come from?
Sorry, I missed that first part.
The correspondence side. So you have correspondence that's obviously substantially higher. Are you getting those from districts as well, or where's that number coming from?
That's coming from districts as well, and that just gives me the indication that clearly there's a push more towards a correspondence type education to give, maybe there's more, that's another option, just parents and the parents maybe are tending to take that route versus brick and mortar.
Okay, thanks.
This is Member Thompson, just to follow up on that correspondence piece. With the increase revenue going to correspondence students. Do you see any correlation between, what do they get, 90%?
It is.
Yes.
Correct. Now, the numbers are higher. Do you see that's why they're higher, because they're getting more for them?
Member Thompson, that's a very good question. It could be related to that. I don't have the history of how the correspondence has fluctuated over the years and if it correlates to that increase.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on the operating budget? So I'll just address the capital budget. So the capital budget was passed by the legislature last Thursday, signed by the governor yesterday. Overall, it was about $1.4 billion capital budget, of which $128 million was the unrestricted general funds for 17 and 18. For the department, we didn't have anything in the original capital budget, but in this final one, there's approximately $1.7 million that's been reappropriated for the Kivalina K-12 replacement school. That is the remaining amount needed to fund that project based on the consent decree. And then there was $3.5 million that was reappropriated to the major maintenance grant fund. So the department will work on trying to get projects appropriated from that fund in order to work down the major maintenance list. Any questions on that?
This is Member Thompson. So with regard to Kivalina, it's done.
Okay. From, yes, Member Thompson, are based on the department's discussions and our current understanding that this is the last amount that needs to be appropriated to fund the project based on what we agreed to in the settlement.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on the capital budget? I guess someone's going to address the intent language that was in the operating budget for the department. And I want to bring these to your attention because two of them relate to the state board. And so we are going to work on developing a response and then bringing them back to you at your September board meeting for you to approve before we submit to the Office of Management Budget and the Division of Ledge Finance. But the first one is within the executive administration component, and I'm just going to read these, assuming you guys are not aware of them. It is the intent of the legislature that the State Board of Education report to the Alaska Legislature with findings and recommendations to ensure equity and affordable access to high-speed internet, broadband services, and connectivity to all school districts in Alaska. Further, it is the intent of the legislature that the State Board of Education address this in context of its best practices initiative, which is basically Alaska's Education Challenge. So that's one of them. Does anybody have any comments regarding that?
So they're requesting that we address this in Alaska's Education Challenge. Is that basically what they're saying?
Chair Fields, this is Santa Eford. If you recall, I believe it was when the State Board visited and actually presented during one of the Education Committee meetings, there was some discussion about, I think, both of these pieces of legislative intent. And I will just share the Department of Law has given all the agencies their opinion that legislative intent is not binding for a department. However, we always try to look into what the legislature has asked us to do and comment to the best of our ability if it's something that we can address in some way. So this was discussed, and it did come up during some of the discussions about the use of the Alaska's education funding, the $250,000 increment that we received. However, as I just stated, it is not binding for this to actually be part of that challenge or that money, but it was a big discussion during all the session, of course, bandwidth for all of our districts and schools. And so it was just brought up to make sure that the State Board in some way was part of helping that to be a focus.
Okay.
This is Member Thompson. With regard to that one piece of intent language, it is one of the Alaska Challenge committees supposed to take this up?
Again, this was not directly what we are letting each of the Alaska Challenge committees do. All the membership, all the committee members themselves, of course, as you know, being on committee, have put forward their ideas, and they're working toward that. I believe the Modernization and Finance Committee have actually talked and had discussions about bandwidth. And also, I think, in student learning, that's come up, and some of the committees have talked about it. But it was not a directive from the department or the governor to include that. So I think as each committee talks about their recommendations, it will either bubble to the surface or not.
Well, I guess, I don't know, if with intent language, when it says we're supposed to report to the legislature on this, if somebody doesn't take it up, how are we supposed to report on it?
Well, as I stated, legislative intent is not binding for the department. We will work with, and Heidi and I are talking about that, and we will be crafting with libraries. Valerie, who is the contractor that works on the E-rate and some, so we're going to work through what we're doing at this point in time, and we will look at if any of the Alaska Challenge committees come up with everything that we can put an address into this intent, but we'll be drafting a response to this that we will bring back to the board to let you look at and see how we go forward with that.
And I would just ask, you know, in our intent, it's not to, you know, ignore what the legislature said. I mean, we respect that. There are other folks, though, other agencies that are doing work around broadband and that kind of thing. And so it may not necessarily be that we have to conduct all of it, but I think we hopefully can get data and information and kind of look at it from an education perspective and then show up at the legislature next year and share some of that information. So it may not look like we doing an in-depth study and maybe taking some information from some of the other things happening or whatever. But again, you know, we have to evaluate what our capacity is and if we have people and, you know, whatever to do that. But if we can, we don't have the people to go out and do our own captive study, but we certainly could maybe use that as another thing.
And this is Member Thompson again. I just want to be sure that James, our chair, when he's giving his report in January, or does the board have another face-to-face meeting with our joint education committee, that we've this may come up and that we're prepared to discuss it and have some ideas at hand. I just don't want this to get lost.
No, and that's absolutely, Member Thompson. That's why we're bringing it now. We want you to know that it was passed as part of our operating budget and the other piece that Heidi will read in just a minute. So that's why we want to make sure that we do a really good job of sharing and writing a response that shows what our or the state board's responsibility is in that area and what we are not, why we are not able to maybe address the full piece. But we will bring that back to the board and make sure that you feel comfortable with that response in a way that you can speak to legislators about that.
All right. Hi, this is Member Gallagher. Thank you for that, Barbara. Just my personal opinion here, this topic is and should be a high priority for the Board of Education. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. So the second one that is under our early learning coordination component, it is the intent of the legislature that the State Board of Education evaluate and make recommendations on strategies to ensure access to quality early educational opportunities for all Alaskan children. Further, it is the intent of the legislature that early learning be prioritized by the department and the State Board of Education as they set long-term strategies to address Alaska's educational challenges.
Holy cow. Again, it really fits nicely into what's happening with Alaska's Education Challenge. However, as I stated before and the commissioner has stated, we're waiting for our committees to work through what their recommendations will be with, and of course, the state board members are chairing those. So I believe in the student learning committee, they're talking about early learning, and it has been part of that conversation. Whether that rises to the level of being a recommendation that comes out of that for the public education system or not, we'll wait to see. But I think through the efforts going around Alaska's Education Challenge, we can respond strongly to these things and say, yes, they were part of the conversation. It may actually come up to be a recommendation, and so we'll have a great response then. However, this was kind of the cart before the horse to get through the this initiative and see what recommendations end up coming forward.
And this is Heidi again, and it might just continue what Santa says. It might be one of those things due to the timing of when we have to reply to this, that we point to the challenge and we point to the fact that the recommendations will be coming, right, and that, you know, we can't, we need to let this initiative continue through its course.
I'm assuming that these, I don't know where these came from, if they came from the actual education committees, but you also have to remember that we have legislators on each committee, so I'm assuming they'll be aware of that and prioritize this. But I know even in the modernization committee, we've talked about the early years and in the whole systemic collaboration piece. So I'm sure a lot of these are being talked about in several of the committees, so you should get some good information on them coming out of the committees.
And Chair Phillips, this is Sam again. I agree. I think we are well covered with our intent for the department and the state board to address these issues. Both of these have been very high focus, high priority issues for the department and the state board. So it's not like we don't have good work going toward that, but the specifics of the study and some of those things we don't necessarily have the funding for, so we can both speak in a way that says they are a priority and we are working through those with the challenge.
And this is Member Thompson. I guess the last thing I have to say is, in the coming year, I have to say I am somewhat surprised at these intent language statements, only because I'm not seeing a clear support for them throughout the legislature. I know some do and some don't. So it seems like we take a step forward with early learning and then we take a step backwards. So I guess I'd like us to not lose sight of these two issues when we're working with the legislature throughout the coming year, because our department does have early learning in its title, and we do understand the value of early learning. But I don't always see statewide support for it. So I will have to, wade through that water and come up with something. But I'm not disappointed to see this. I just am surprised.
I think both of these were from the Senate. They were the House, the House Education Committees. And there was some discussion in the full Finance Committees about this intent, but they did pass and were included in our operating budget.
That helps. Thank you.
This is Heidi Kushner again, for the record. That's all I have. So if you guys have any questions, you can take them up.
Or move on.
Any questions or comments on this work session item? Not hearing any. Next is break, but we're ahead of schedule, so let's just move on to board comments. And I would, I think, I don't know if we have a committee member to each of the committees, but I would like it if board members spoke possibly just a few sentences on how their committee's going, what their feelings are, if they're getting some good outcomes. And I know that there's three that haven't yet met in August. I guess there's one this afternoon, one tomorrow, and one on the 10th, but maybe just a quick little how it's going would be good too in board comments, if whatever committee you're part of. Mr. V, do you want to have any other comments for today before we go into board comments?
No, we're good. Appreciate everybody's time today and look forward to board comments.
Okay, thank you. So I'll just go down my list. Member Michael. Well,
not hearing him.
I'm right here. Sorry about that. My mic is turned off. This is Member Michael. I'd like to focus my board comments on end of program assessments, end of course assessments. Thank you. I really appreciate the department looking at that, and I've heard from students around the state that they don't really like their kids in Algebra 2 taking the same class as kids in intermediate algebra and geometry, and they had problems with just different levels of experience instead of not like knowledge based on what has been taught. So I appreciate the board looking, the department looking at that. And then in regards to committees, I'm looking forward to the directions that that my committee will be taking. And I've only attended the first meeting because I was out of service range the day of the second one, but that one was awesome, and I look forward to doing it again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Member Michael. Member Hemshoe.
So the Educator Excellence Committee created three subcommittees. Those subcommittees have done a lot of talking, investigating, learning, and we're going to come together and try to narrow down so many good ideas to a few transformational ones. And there's been just an incredible amount of work on the part of both Lisa Parity and the subcommittee chairs. So it's been fantastic to be part of it, especially nice not to be the one leading it. and I think we're going to have some really good ideas to bring forward. did you want me to say anything about the specifics of the ideas, Chair Fields, or just how we're doing with the committee?
Whatever you want. Yeah, that's fine, whichever.
Okay, I don't really feel comfortable trying to say what's rising to the top because I don't think we're at that point yet, but I will say that there's a lot of really great stuff that we're thinking about and talking about. And as far as other comments, I'm just really excited about the ESSA plan. I am grateful for all the hard work, and I really appreciate the gentle way that people have guided me through what the different parts of it mean and have so patiently answered my questions. So thank you for that. And that's all I have.
Great. Thank you. Member Gallahorn.
Thank you. Hope everyone's having a great summer. Our committee is doing very well, I think. Very positive. We kind of had a difficult time finding a direction. It kept changing, but I think we're back on track. And the people that are on this committee are awesome, great. They're working very hard, and things are going well. Well, this can be, I think, after tomorrow's meeting, we'll be. We should be a little farther ahead than we are now, but I think we're going to catch up tomorrow. We don't quite have the three areas identified yet, but we're close. We'll do that tomorrow, hopefully. So that's going well. Very, very pleased with it. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Kenny. Member Hamilton.
I don't have any further comments. See you folks, I believe, next month.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if Member Hull was able to join us or not. Are you there, Sue? Okay, she's traveling, so it's no surprise. Member Thompson.
Member Hull and I are co-chairs of the Student Learning Committee, and I'm just continually shocked by how well this committee functions, especially given those long audio conferences that we're having, but they are a committed group, and we meet this afternoon at 1 o'clock. We have narrowed down to three areas. I'm not going to go into the areas simply because we're going to talk about specific language for those strategic priorities, and then specific language for the rationale behind them. I'm not sure if we are ever going to get to an action plan, which is at this point optional according to Jerry Covey. But we may get to that and entertain ideas on actually how to accomplish some of these things, but that is not our priority at this point. It's coming up with the strategic priorities and the rationale. Nancy Norman is an excellent facilitator, and we're doing really well. I just, again, can't believe how people have rallied to meet on the side and do extra work, and when they show up for these audios, they stick with it the whole time. So I commend everybody involved with the Student Learning Committee, because we're getting there, and we're getting there fast.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any other comments, Member Thompson?
No, other than it's not raining here, and so we're, like, feeling good.
Well, good. I guess that's me. I'm on both the Safety and Wellbeing Committee and Modernization Finance Committee, and both of those are going well. The Safety and Wellbeing is farther ahead than the Modern and Finance, but Safety and Wellbeing tends to be a little easier than Modernization Finance. That's quite a large bite to take off. But they're both going well. People are engaged. I'm glad to hear all the committees are going well and moving forward. So hopefully we can get the department some things here in the next couple of months to look at, and of course get the board things to look at, because then we get to take them and flesh out what recommendations we do first. So I'm glad things are going well, and our two meetings were last week, so we're done with our third meeting, and not till the end of the month we had another one. So that's good. Thanks for all the work on ESSA, and Rebecca, thanks for those questions. Those were probably some of the ones other board members had, so you kind of jumped ahead, got them to them so they could get the feedback back, and so that helped out all the board members, I'm sure. So don't feel bad that you're asking a bunch of questions. That's good for all board members to hear. And with that, without objection, we will adjourn.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.